Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament Lectionary Podcast for preachers and teachers. My name is Paul Ethan. I am a PhD student in Hebrew Bible Old Testament Studies at Yale University.
And I'm Rosie Candlethal. I'm an assistant professor in the area of biblical studies in the study of religions department at Wake Forest University. And we are back with you, listeners, with biblical insights for March 30th, 2025, the fourth week of Lent. And our first reading this week is taken from Joshua chapter 5, verses 9 to 12. And Paul, it's tough to preach out of Joshua. So here you are. You've got the mic. You've got the hot seat. What might preachers take away from a passage in what is often a dreaded book of Joshua?
When I saw Joshua, before I saw that it was chapter 9, I thought, oh, Lord, please not conquest the game. I don't want to be talking about conquest.
It's already a hard week.
It's somewhat about conquest, but, you know, at least the lectionary cuts off early enough so that we don't get quite close. But I looked and was like, circumcision. Well, that's still brutal and bloody, but it's not the same as warfare. So I will take that.
I'll take circumcision over conquest.
But reading it carefully, I feel like there's a lot of good things here. And I would describe Joshua chapter 5, 9 through 12 as theologically weighty. And this is where you get the famous line, "Today I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you." Right?
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean? It is the passage that, you know, people, the Israelites celebrate the first Passover in the new land they've just like arrived upon. And ultimately, it is about new beginnings. It is about new identity. There's something also about divine provision. But before I get ahead of myself, I would do some context work. Joshua follows the story of the Israelites coming out of Egypt into the new land, Canaan, the land that God had promised to the ancestors, aka Abraham and his descendants. This passage in chapter 5 occurs after their miraculous crossing of the Jordan, which echoes some of the crossing, like, you know, imagery and scene in Exodus 14, which is where they actually cross the Sea of Reeds, right? And here in chapter 5, there are a few, you know, thematic topical areas. I named three here. Male-born children of the new generation in the wilderness are here circumcised. Right? That's why we have all the circumcision narrative. And here it seems like circumcision is like a way of renewing covenant. Again, the covenant language that we have thematized so far in our various Lenten first reading passages. And then the second thing here is God does declare that the disgrace of Egypt is removed, right? This is where we get close to like the burdens and the weight of Egypt and the slavery that it brought to the people, and then like all of the implications of that, the legacies of that, that oppression lifted off. And then the third thing here is like, they are here on the land, they eat of the land for the first time. You know, there's like manna, which they relied upon for like 40 years. This time around, manna ceases in a new form of food production and dependency on agriculture sort of begins, right? So in many ways, this is a big threshold moment for the people of Israel. They are no longer wandering. They are becoming settlers in a land that previously they had only imagined and dreamt about. And for most of them, their parents had dreamt of the land because they were just inheriting the dream from the ancestors, most of which they died in the wilderness. So that's like the brief context, both historically and literally, that I can, literarily, I would say, that I could give.
So as you said, right, this is a threshold moment, right? Things have changed. What kinds of other things might you kind of observe about this moment?
The very first thing for me, I think, is in verse 9, right? So verse 9, if we go to the Hebrew right here, it says, "Vayomer Adonai el Yoshua Hayom galoti et harpat mitzrayim me'elechem v'ikrashem hamakom hachu gilgal ad hayom hazeh." Right? Basically, the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away from mm-hmm. you the disgrace, or whatever that word means, I'll get to that briefly, of Egypt. And so that the place where you are right now will be named after that event, Gilgal, to this day. Right? So the very first thing in this line is definitely the language of Shopat Mitzrayim, which is like the disgrace of Egypt, you know, in simple terms. But Hiopa often is translated as disgrace as I have done, but also reproach. And it means a few things, right? Sometimes, for me, I think more even appropriately, suggests some kind of a shame or dishonor that is inflicted upon one person by another person or another group of people or by an event. So something happened that sort of inflicted shame and dishonor upon. Basically a damage of one's reputation or identity or memorial. And note that it is used here in relationship with Egypt. So what is being inflicted as dishonor here upon the name and the identity of Israel is, you know, this whole chain of they being an enslaved people, worsened by their disobedience in the wilderness and the ridicule that they face from, you know, other surrounding people. And I note that, you know, what God is doing about this whole process is rolling this, like, you know, disgrace away. It's essentially fixing that damaged reputation and damaged identity and legacy and memorial. And that's where I feel like there's, you know, some meat, something really striking, that God does this work very publicly through the wonder of the crossing of the sea and bestowing upon them a new land, and like circumcising like newer generations, renewing the covenant and providing better ways of they feeding themselves. It's like this public fixing of the disgrace, of the dishonor that has been inflicted on them. And I get this public resonance here in verse 1. This is when all the kings of the Amorites beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the Israelites until they had crossed over, their hearts melted. And there was no longer any spirit in them because of the Israelites. So there was a hearing of what God had done, like the news of what God had done went out into the nations. And it is in that proclamation, in that work of the spreading of the good thing that God had done for the people, that the rolling away of the disgrace, the bad reputation, the bad legacy, the negative dishonoring identity is sort of rolled away, is corrected, is fixed. While I'm at it, is the language of Gilgal, right? The rolling away. We know it as a place name, but the place gets its name from the act, God's act of galaling, rolling away. Fixing and fixing of the identity has become monumental, memorialized in a much more concrete, tangible way through the renaming of the place or the naming of the place Gilgal, right? So again, all that I'm alluding to here is like the beauty of the language of taking away disgrace and how that disgrace, beyond every other possibility, seems to me as though it's a fixing of the reputation of Israel in the eyes of the other nation, because that's where the disgrace comes in. That's where the dishonor comes into.
Yeah, I think you're also pointing to something really important about the value of ritual, right? So you could easily maybe reclaim your dignity or roll away disgrace by conquest, by strength, right?
Yep.
But instead, what's happening here is there's a pause. Something's being acknowledged that maybe a trauma has been endured by this people. They do not have an identity other than not slaves,
yes.
Not landed.
Yes.
Not, you know, so all these sort of low, like not my people, not, you know, like all these kinds of things that, as you say, are a disgrace in the world.
Yes.
But in that moment, there is a, you know, you pause here, you take stock, you acknowledge, and now there's an act in this rolling away that it's not abstract. Now God will ask them to do certain ritual acts to mark, as you said, monumental memorializing of a change.
That's right.
And what that will be, let's see what they roll into, but terrible. At least something is rolling away from them, right? You do not have to own this. this shame that you've endured, however you're experiencing this thing. I might even just think about this in terms of trauma theory in general, right? And the work of letting that roll off, of now maybe accepting something new, something uncertain, but something different, right? I mean, something different in the ritual that these people are now acknowledging in the openness of what's going to happen in the rest of Joshua. And the story continues beyond that. Yeah.
Certainly.
So what other time? I mean, obviously something is going to happen here at Gilgal, right?
By all means.
Right. So what is actually going to happen here? Right. So you've talked all about the framing here, but what's the significance of the rest of this narrative?
Well, I have two other things that I want to talk about. Definitely, like, you will not skip the subject of circumcision, right? It's all over the first half of the chapter. And it seems like circumcision is being performed here as symbolizing the covenant renewal, sort of expanding, as I've alluded to early on some of the identity fixing project here in verse 9. But it looks like here circumcision includes the new generation, the people who were not previously circumcised. And I think that's why circumcision is being ordered again, the steward again, because there are new young men that have been born among us while we were in the wilderness. They ought to be included in the covenant, not that they are not, but symbolically included in the covenant. And circumcision, as we know, was the agreed upon medium through which, like, God will mark the people of Israel as separated for God's work, right? Typified for God's relationship. And of course, it is not a unique thing to Israel. Only other cultures in the ancient Near East had that, but, like, you know, Israel sort of indigenized, if I should use that word, indigenized circumcision and used it quite uniquely. And for me, I think, aside from wondering how, in a very, really comic way, how mass circumcision went, for instance, how did they cut everybody? How did they stop the bleeding for all these people? How many tears were there? Note that like 10, 15 verses after they were getting ready for war, right? And then all these men were circumcised. So I just want to know how all of that went about. But apart from that, I want to draw attention to how communal this identity fixing project was. Sometimes we're overtly personal about our relationship with God. It's like, my God, my practice, my Lent, my process, my ritual, right? But here it seems as though circumcision is part of a grandiose theological act enacted for this particular group of people. It's not personal, it's communal, it's everybody. It's like everybody that needs to be circumcised. And what we see here in this passage, and probably many other places, is less of an individual participating in the benefit of relating with God, but more of a people doing it often, like it's whole family, it's a whole nation, it's like, you know, a whole people group and so on and so forth. So the communal aspect of circumcision, I think, strikes me far more than the bloody parts of it.
I genuinely am asking because I'm curious about how you see this idea of circumcision as something that initiates a communal identity, right? So I'm as a woman, just kind of thinking about what were the women in this community doing, right? I mean, it seems as though it feels like a male ritual, right? And it seems almost exclusive to the men in the community. So I wonder what it was like to be a woman or a girl and to maybe perhaps be a witness to something like this. And as you said, Joshua is a precursor to war, right? It's a male story in that sense. Yeah. You don't get a lot of women in Joshua up. And so, you know, I just am genuinely curious about how you maybe see that.
Yeah, and that's a genuine question. I think that's the limitation of circumcision being what it is, because although it extends beyond the person, an individual, it does certainly exclude women, right? Yes. And in that case, then it's not like truly communal. But I guess what I'm like alluding to here is if circumcision symbolizes a certain benefit that Israel as a people participate in, which is the covenant with God, right? Then it is not like one person, aka Abraham, an ancestor somewhere who only participated in that, but like everybody else who comes through Abraham. And at least it sets apart this whole like individualistic way of claiming and benefit from God as mine, but then like broadens it out to a people. Of course, it is fronted as like the people that is fronted here is like the male people. And that's the limitation of the whole thing. So certainly, yes, I should acknowledge that it does have a limitation in that it is super male-centered and it's focused on male genitalia. and that's not cool. But thinking about that in relationship with like what they do with food and, you know, like the grand understanding of covenant with God for the people of God, for me, I think there's something about like it taking away some individualist claims about the benefit, you know.
I think to that point, one thing you reminded me too of is that circumcision, at least one of the interpretations is that it's a dedication of the seed, right? So this is a connection to the idea of manna too, is that the recognition that what is issuing from this male genitalia is something that could go toward creating new life. And that the dedication of that in the symbol of the foreskin is in some sense a recognition that you're entering into a new identity, and that the people that are issuing forth from this are dedicated to God in a new way or in a special way. And so I see your point there with that sense. And perhaps there's a connection then also to the ceasing of manna, and now an idea that you are going to be settled in this land, planting seeds, harvesting a new life that is settled in the land with new children and a new generation. So
indeed.
A hopeful moment there. Yeah.
Indeed. I think if we think about circumcision for a minute, definitions of circumcision doesn't end in the Hebrew Bible. I think that Second Temple Judaism definitely take up the definition of it. New Testament take up the definition of it. There is like concepts such as circumcision of the heart, right? So I feel like some of the male-centered problematic aspects of circumcision is somewhat fixed, at least in the New Testament, where it takes out circumcision as this literal thing that you do to a male penis, for instance, right? And it's a concept that can be applied even to the heart as a metaphor symbolizing inclusion into the covenant of God.
Yeah.
In a way that doesn't like have this sort of gender-centeredness of it, but really prioritizes the concept of new covenant that includes everybody, not just the people with like, you know, genitalia necessarily.
Yeah, that's helpful too, right? Yeah, to think about that metaphor being extended to the heart, to something even broader than male genitalia. Yeah, maybe there's a new identity in that too, right?
Maybe there is, yeah.
Okay, so it sounds as though you might be moving towards some preaching angles. Is that where we want to maybe head?
Yeah, you're hearing right. And the new identity sits, for me, in stark contrast with their past identity. And so here, the past is important to appreciate the present and then the future. Yes. And I might invite preachers to consider Egypt as a place of oppression, the disgrace of Egypt as a byproduct of the place of oppression alongside Gilgal, which is like the rolling, the act of God rolling away Egypt and everything that it represents. And for me, I think that these three points frame the passage very well and bring out like some of these tangible points that offer great encouragement to people. And this is also where I might bring in some of the gospel passage. The gospel passage that we have for this week is Luke 15, which has a series of like lost parables. And one of them is the parable of the prodigal son, prodigality.
Yes.
And so while Joshua chapter 5, 9 through 12 is about people stepping into their new identity, leaving behind shame and dishonor, I feel like Luke 15 is about a son returning home and stepping back into sonship after leaving, you know, in disgrace, depending on how you read it. In Joshua, God removes the Israelites, like their identity of shame. And in Luke chapter 15, the father's embrace removes the shame of the son, right? Yes. Bringing home. I'm sure preachers get the point. I also would like to think about food in this particular passage. The shift from manna to food grown on the land or on land for me, also echoes some of the lessons that our relationship with the past can teach us about, like, right now. And I keep thinking about how it's easy, you know, that they could have just, like, stuck with mana and God could have just said, yeah, let's just do this thing. It's, like, quick food. It's instant. It falls from heaven. You don't have to wait for the land to be ready for planting. You don't have to wait for the rain. Nobody has to labor to cook, harvest. All of that is skipped. It's just straight food. And if you need more, it's going to keep coming. But, you know, it's easy to cling to old ways. And old ways of God's provision than to, you know, embrace the new ways, which may be difficult, but perhaps a lot more sustainable, right? A lot more, like, involving of people and a lot more involving of community. And so the imagery of feasting here broadly for me, I think it's, like, inspiring. And thinking here about also the Passover feast, you know, as a meal of remembrance. When we compare that to Luke chapter 15, the father throws a feast to the returning son, right? And there's plenty of food imagery that preachers can play with here. But for me, ultimately, it looks like God's gracious work among us is, for the most part, celebrated with good food. And good food is a good thing.
I really like that message. I can get with that. I really like this point that you're making, too, that manna is only a temporary provision, right? And it's a wilderness provision, and that it was never intended to be permanent food, right? And that this was, it's a stopgap. Like, you have an infant, right? So, I mean, you're not meant to drink breast milk for the rest of your life, although it has everything you need, really. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about this substance, but it is only for babies. Right. When you grow, you're intended to have a larger palate. You're intended to figure out what you enjoy, what tastes good to you, right? All these kind of invitations to adulthood, which to me, I'm hearing the resonance there in all of these passages is that, you know, Lent is also an invitation to grow into this identity, right? And to choose things that taste good and to make that kind of adult decision, you know, where it isn't just food that's being handed to you. That's not what God intends. God intends for this relationship to be something more mature. That's a really wonderful invitation in the fourth week of Lent to hear and to maybe walk into these next couple of weeks, which will be difficult as we move into Passion and, you know, all those that are to come, right?
Yes, exactly. I think Lent is that season, like turning to God, letting God shape us, reshape us, mold us, grow us, prune us, all the difficult words, you know? And I think that this text invites preachers to help their congregants to reflect on what God is rolling away, what new provisions is God offering, and how do we embrace all of that, like restored identities and so on and so forth.
Well put, Paul, and I'm sure our preachers and listeners have received something maybe new for this fourth week of Lent as they take these insights forward. So, folks, we're going to close our podcast here today. But if you want more, hey, we've got more. Remember to check out past episodes on our website at firstreadingpodcast.com. And if you do find this podcast helpful to you, we would love for you to pass this on to a friend, another preacher, another teacher that might also enjoy hearing us talk about the lectionary text. Please leave us a review wherever you find us, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can find us just about everywhere. And until next time, I am Rosie Candiful.
And I am Paul Lesser. Your preaching bring light this lecture.
Amen.